From the Sky News Centre at 5, a man from York has lost his bid to have a rare sexual risk order lifted. A judge says he's persuaded that it is necessary in order to protect John O'Neill's future partners. He's been having to inform police 24 hours before he has sex. The IT consultant says the order breaches his human rights. A woman's under arrest after a 3-year-old boy was killed by a dog in Essex. The 29-year-old's being held for allowing an animal to be dangerously out of control. The American Bulldog is in police kennels after the attack on Dexter Neal late yesterday afternoon. Harriet Taylor lives next door in Halstead. She's in shock.
Heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, especially having a 5-year-old daughter, it just sort of brings it home a little bit more, and it's just awful. Can't believe it.
American swimming gold medalist Ryan Lochte has apologised for his behaviour during an evening out in Rio. Richard Newman reports from the Olympic Park.
Lochte says he should have been more responsible, careful and candid when describing the events of a night out last weekend. He initially claims that both himself and fellow US swimmers had been robbed after having a gun pointed at them. But CCTV showed a petrol station had been vandalised after they'd been to a party and weapons were drawn until they paid for the damages. Lochte, one of the big stars of American swimming, says he's learned some valuable lessons.
The state of the public finances is worse than expected, meaning the Chancellor may have less leeway when it comes to tax cuts and spending increases. There was a budget surplus of £1 billion last month, short of the £1.6 billion experts hoped for. One of the main strategists behind Donald Trump's campaign for the White House has quit. Paul Manafort has come under fire for his ties to Russian interests in Ukraine. And Twitter is taking action after criticism that it doesn't do enough to combat harassment. The site's announced a new filter designed to root out posts users don't want to see or that could be abusive. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
The real sound of Bristol. BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. And helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Central Ward, Kai Dodd. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news a few weeks ago, we heard from German-born political scientist Klaus Kopf, the director of the Hamburg Peace Studies Institute, Dieter Lutz, had screamed at him, "You naive blue-eyed bleep, do you think the US president is really voted in? Where do you live?" Now, the evidence is rolling in that Lutz was right. No less than 5 suspicious deaths of people closely connected to the Democratic National Committee, who were all in a position to blow the whistle on the conspiracy to make Hillary Clinton the Democratic Party's presidential candidate. Also, Crimea, Russian and Ukrainian troops massing on either side of the border there after a saboteur cell of Ukrainian soldiers was arrested by the Russians inside Crimea. They're above the law, and the banksters should never be far from the headlines, as today's medieval overlords deciding on which companies live and which companies die. Nearly 100 senior bankers have died, most in suspicious circumstances over the last 3 years. Why is nobody joining the dots? Plus, the crowd-funded documentary The Killings of Tony Blair is out. We have a sneak preview and ask, has our own film and TV industry lost the will to investigate domestic corruption and war crimes? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of other world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 degrees Celsius, windy, with some showers. This weekend, highs of 21 Celsius, sunshine mixed with gale force winds and heavy showers on Saturday. The winds will die down and it'll be drier and brighter on Sunday. Next week, highs of 27, really hot, warm and fairly sunny week with the possibility of some thundery downpours. Next weekend, the 27th and 28th of August, highs of 21 Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Central Ward, Kai Dudd. Hi, Kai. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for inviting me on.
Tell us a bit about your background, because you're a new city councillor now, aren't you?
Yeah, I was elected in May, but my background is that I'm a trade union official in Bristol for the Communication Workers Union. So my background for them is within the postal industry and Royal Mail. So I've worked for Royal Mail for well over 10 years now. I've been a union official for about the same time as well.
So you're actually a postie, or you're sorting mail as well as working with the CWU?
My background's more of a clerical background, so obviously I'm part of the CWU with the
So what were you doing in the mail service then?
I was dealing with payroll, some administrational duties, some HR duties.
Well, look, you're obviously an insider, right? So tell us what's been going on over the last 10 years as the privatisation has rolled out.
Right, so I suppose we've obviously just had 2 or 3 years of privatisation now. The big changes, in my honest opinion, haven't come through yet. I think the union's in quite a strong position. And it's kind of holding the line, but you can see with the shareholders' attitudes now that things are changing, especially around issues like the pension fund. So in Royal Mail, we've got a defined benefit scheme, and the shareholders and the chief executives are saying it's no longer affordable. You have to have a similar pension scheme to other FTSE 100 companies.
Okay, so they're trying to turn it from a public sector pension scheme into a private sector pension scheme. And these pension schemes, let's face it, more and more news reports saying they're incredibly flaky, basically.
Yeah, I saw a document which outlined the difference between, it's very, very technical language, a defined benefit scheme and a defined contribution scheme. But someone who would expect to retire on £10,000 a year under the alternative scheme would expect to retire on £6,000, so it's a £4,000 a year difference. And I think if you put it in those terms, and so people kind of get that rather than just talking about the name of a scheme. So it's a way of picking postal workers' pockets.
Well, and it might sound boring, pensions, but it does concentrate the minds of working people. Quite obviously, if you're putting money into a scheme, you want to know you're going to get something at the end of it. What about the front end of the postal service, the way that things like collection times and delivery times have changed?
Well, deliveries are getting later and later. Collections, the number of post boxes has reduced over the years as well. We've seen a decline in letter traffic, but the growth area is the small packets and parcels from internet shopping. So there is a bright future to the industry.
Well, they're saying that a lot of these high street shops, I was reading the other day, tens of thousands of people are going to lose their jobs in shops because this is going to be the future, internet shopping. So there's still going to be a need for the postal service to be good, efficient, you know, to do its job properly.
Yeah, I agree with that. I met, I don't know if you know, Broadmead's in the process over the next 5 to 10 years of being redeveloped. And what I was told when I was meeting the architects is that retailers no longer want small shops. They need big spaces to showcase their goods. So people may come into the shop to have a look at the goods, but then go online to buy them online.
So. Oh, this is, I mean, it's a bit of a joke, really, isn't it? I mean, I can remember when George Ferguson, before he was mayor, was saying when Cabot Circus was being built, he was saying, well, I think we really need to make sure there's places for small businesses. He was even suggesting a whole floor of Cabot Circus for local small businesses. Of course, that never happened. And what we've got now is, if you go to the top floor, half the place is pretty much empty. Which is incredible. If you go into the galleries, in fact, you see their first charity shop has come into the galleries, supposedly a prime retail centre, and now the charity shops are coming in there too.
Yeah, I think Broadmead's always been sort of mid-market, hasn't it, anyway? But yeah, like you say, it is a surprise to see sort of the charity shops sort of moving in. But
Also round Quakers Friars, if you walk around there, you'll find many of the shops empty. I mean, I think, you know, round gosh, I'm not sure what it's called, a little square around by the old Quakers Friars area, almost all the shops are empty there. So we're seeing a death of the retail, I think. I mean, that's what it looks like if you wander around central Bristol there.
Yeah, I think the area that you mentioned, I think that was sort of reserved for the sort of higher end sort of fashion brands and higher end
they
retailers.
Had things like kind of Gucci bag, and they had a permanent sale on for 3 or 4 months, then they closed.
Hugo Boss, people like that. And I don't think it's quite worked there, because as I said before, I think the tradition of the shopping there has always been sort of mid-market rather than high-end retailers.
Well, yeah, I mean, so the high-end retailers are giving up and going away at the moment, but that's are there any other parts of Central Ward that you point to as interesting, you know, where you got engaged at all?
I really like... It's quite a transient population, because you've obviously got loads of students that come and go, young professionals that come in that may be here for a year. But there are some settled communities like Redcliffe, and I really like Redcliffe and the sort of community there. Obviously, mainly council tenants there, but there's a real community spirit there, and there's some really good people doing a lot of work to improve the community and make it a great place.
Just back to the CWU for a minute. Is it just postal workers you represent? Because I would imagine communication, telecoms as well?
Yeah, we've got three sections actually. So we represent postal workers, so Royal Mail and the Post Office, and then we've got a telecommunications section.
Is there anybody working in telecommunications anyway? I think this stuff just kind of works itself, doesn't it?
I think we've got about 80,000 members in those industries. So BT, EE, and also we represent some financial services workers, places like Santander. I think they took over the contract for Gyro Bank, so it's a bit of a legacy that we've got the members there, because obviously Gyro Bank was Tony Benn's sort of idea of a post bank and the post office providing banking services, which I think is still a good idea, actually.
Well, you're part of quite a big change in Bristol in May in the local elections, where Bristol was really taken over by the Labour Party. Marvin Rees is elected as mayor. Have you seen any real difference? Or, I mean, I suppose you weren't actually a councillor beforehand, but what do you think is the mission for the new council led by Labour?
Well, obviously, in the news this week is Marvin's first 100 days. And obviously, there's a difficult situation in Bristol with the finances. So there's money that we're going to have to save. And it's probably going to be job losses. And obviously, we'll...
OK, this is the big question for me. Is how much of a fuss is Marvin making about this? Because we know the banksters have run off with the loot. He should be banging his fist on the table saying, give it back. Arrest these guys.
Well, I agree with you. I think there's been one banker that's gone to jail since 2008, hasn't there?
I think they're more like low-level traders that have been going to jail rather than the blue-blood bankers.
But I think sometimes local government is a symptom of the problem. So I think by attacking the symptom rather than the cause, I don't think you really get anywhere. And I think, I know people say, oh, we can pass an illegal budget, that kind of thing. But I think if you do that, you sort of give up your
really,
sovereignty.
All I'm really saying here is to what extent Marvin is making a fuss about it. Not necessarily changing the budget or whatever, but he's making it clear that this is being done under duress. Do you think he's doing that?
Oh, well, without a doubt. I think, you know, it's clearly not what a Labour administration wants to come in to do to cut money out of a budget. That's obviously going to affect frontline services and affect the number of jobs in the city. So it's not what we set out to do, but we can do things. We can think outside of the box. So in terms of the housing agenda, which is at the top of our agenda, actually, I think we're making progress on that. We've announced 600 builds so far, and there's more to come. And we're looking at developing our own land. I think you had Paul Smith on the show
a couple of months
recently.
Ago, yeah.
So I think we're going to make progress on that, and we're going to set up our own company to develop our own land, so we get affordable housing.
Yeah, better get cracking. It takes a few years to build houses.
Well, yeah. I mean, 600 already in a few months, I think, is good progress. And we've said we'll get up to a rate of 2,000 a year by 2020.
But can the council afford to clean the streets?
Can the council afford to clean the streets? I don't know.
Well, because I mean, certainly where I'm in St Paul's, the streets, absolutely, particularly around Portland Square, is absolutely. I mean,
well, I
must
admit,
seems to be weeks and weeks before anybody's cleaned it. I actually noticed some guy from Cozy's Wine Bar actually out there cleaning the streets himself because they were in such a mess.
I must admit, being the councillor for sort of BS1, there are major issues with rubbish collections in BS1 and recycling issues. And we have been promised by Bristol Waste that there'll be progress on that. So
is this Bristol Waste? Is this new-ish in-house waste company?
Yeah.
And is it working?
It's what they call, I think they call a tekkle company. So I think...
What does that stand for?
I've got no idea.
Okay.
Sorry about that. But I think obviously the council can set up to run a service, but it also allows it to make 20% profit on top of what it does. So that profit can come back in to fund other services. So obviously commercial waste isn't handled by Bristol Waste at the moment, so hopefully they once they're established as the provider for residential waste, they can make profit by providing commercial services as well, which would obviously make a better rubbish collection service because it'll be better funded, but also some of that money can come back into the council.
Well, I've actually asked Marvin Rees on this show about a month ago. No reply. I'm getting a kind of an omerta from all our MPs actually at the moment.
Right.
And I'd just like to repeat this every once in a while, just to let people know it's not that we're not trying to get these MPs on. They don't want to know, which is a bit worrying. Both all of the three Labour and all of the three Conservative MPs all saying no. That's Thangam Debonair, Karen Smith in South Bristol, Kerry McCarthy, also Jack Lopresti. Obviously Charlotte Leslie is ill, so I wouldn't expect her to come in. She's just had an operation, but also Chris Skidmore. I mean, we've been doing this show how many years, Martin? Probably 7 years or something. He's two or three times promised to come on and then cancelled at the last minute. Right. So the MPs don't seem to want to get an interrogation, but they got an interrogation of sorts on the One Love Breakfast on Monday, and Marvin was there. Marvin was chatting to Pat Hart on the One Love Breakfast, and Pat asked him about, I think it was a question about the street cleaning, the one I just asked you pretty much.
We're going to be launching, and we'll talk to you about it, but we're going to be launching a Clean Streets campaign, right?
Yeah.
My mum lives on Stapleton Road. She hates walking along, and she thinks it's dirty, it's filthy.
Mm.
You know, we all know this, right? This is a massive Bristol challenge, from fly tipping to litter to how we use our waste. Mm. And it's all connected to, you know, recycling and reuse as well.
And it's a cause that your mum's committed to as well.
My mum won an award for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, BS5 award.
But
we're going to do something. But, you know, we are not going to be able to deliver clean streets just by working through Bristol Waste, the Bristol City Council owned company.
Yeah.
That actually takes local ownership, local engagement, community leadership, community organising. So we can't, not just practically, but financially, we just can't afford to go around picking up all the litter in the city.
Sure.
We can't afford to pick up the litter in the city. Martin Summers, it sounds a bit like the Big Society. Please, everybody, get together and help us pick up the rubbish.
Well, yes, but I mean, as Kai was pointing out earlier, if you're not going to make illegal budgets, then you've got to accept the constraints that central government have placed on you, and that means that you're going to have to cut your coat according to your cloth.
If we're all paying our council tax and they can't even pick the rubbish up, what on earth is
because
the point of paying the council tax?
Council tax only pays a small proportion of the actual spend of Bristol City Council, as I'm sure Kai's aware.
Well, there are certain basic things, aren't they? Collecting waste and rubbish. If the council can't even do that...
Well, if you remember, until recently, it was actually done by what's the name, May Gurney, and they were basically rubbish, and they were making a profit out of it. It makes more sense to have it done in house in this new format.
Now, and, nobody's expecting every little sweet wrapper to be picked up, but there needs to be a kind of reasonably well organised. Company or whatever out there picking up. I mean, it might sound trivial, but this isn't trivial, is it? A lot of people get annoyed with, I mean, I do, with the rubbish around, and this is one of the basic things the council's supposed to do.
If you look at the services the council provide, then it's probably the service that everybody comes into contact with. So we've got some very important services like adult social care and that, but rubbish collections are the service that people come into contact with. So I can see there's that transactional relationship between a rubbish collection and paying your council tax. But as Martin said, I mean, the cuts come from the grant that you get, the local government grant that the government gives to local councils. So although the tax generated locally has probably remained level, it's that the cut in the grant. But also, as Marvin said on that clip, I mean, there's a big problem with fly tipping as well. And in BS1,
well, I can tell you why there's a big problem with fly tipping. Number one is because people are getting charged to take stuff to the tip, and also you've got to have all these documents, prove your identity, prove your address, prove your postcode, etc., before you're allowed to dump anything. So people think, well, I'm not bothering with that, I'm just going to dump it. And if you had if you've got a tip, you should just open it up and let people put it in the tip. Otherwise, they're going to fly tip. It's a no-brainer. That's a real no-brainer.
No, well, I agree.
Don't say to people, look, give us, tell us your life history before you're allowed, and you know, give us your passport before you're allowed to dump some rubbish in the tip.
I mean, another priority is to, I mean, we're looking at opening a third recycling centre in South Bristol. I mean, it's been talked about a long time, but that's another priority to improve, you know, people's access to those services in that part of the city. So. But there are areas where there are structural problems. So, as I said, BS1, the recycling, the ability to recycle there is almost non-existent because of the way people live above shops and down little alleys. So it's very difficult from a practical point of view.
Well, I tell you what, the recyclers have surely got to go up the steps, haven't they?
Well, yeah. Well, it needs to be sort of, or you have a central point where people can take their recyclable goods.
Well, or else the recycling people get a little tag if there's a security thing to get in and take I mean, that happens all over the city with as posties. You'll know that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
posties can go in pretty much anywhere, you know, to deliver their post, and that they could do exactly the same. Maybe we'll move on.
Well, I agree with you. There's a solution. I don't know if that's the solution, though.
Well,
I think maybe central points on.
Well, I know
every
that does happen.
Where you can go and.
I mean, if
you're recycling.
I mean, if there's a private estate that the rubbish collectors are coming in to take the rubbish, then they've got a little a tab to get in, and the doors will open for them. You know, that's just normal. Anyway, there's another subject that got talked about on the One Love Breakfast on Monday, if I can find it, and that is the Bristol Brexit Working Group, because Marvin is very much acknowledging that Bristol did not vote for Brexit, so he's got some plans to do something about it.
It's very well known now that the leaders of the Brexit campaign had no plan, and the EU, no one knows what to do. So my argument in Europe has been, so if there's nothing there, let us make it up right now. We voted to remain in Bristol. I'm not discounting the voices of those voted to leave. I recognise the motivations, but we got to secure our future. So can we as a city broke our own relationship with the EU, broke our own relationship with other nation states, and broke our own relationships with other cities and city regions? So we've opened up those avenues for dialogue, and I've asked our international team to come up with an intentional international strategy for Bristol, which is about our international profile, brand, and where I need to go. Hence, partly my time in New York meeting with Bloomberg's and Rockefeller's and de Blasio and so forth. So we're being very proactive about this. We're not waiting to see what comes down the line from central government.
Yeah, so effectively what Marvin's saying there, Martin, was, well, Bristol didn't vote for Brexit, so we're not necessarily happy with leaving all this to central government to organise. We're going to organise our own relationship with the European Union.
Well, and not just the European Union. He's just said he'd been in New York meeting de Blasio, but then when he mentioned Rockefeller and whoever else it was.
Yeah, a bit of name-dropping there, Marvin.
A bit of name-dropping, but I'm not sure I'm that keen on meeting
those Rockefeller
kind of
is a sort of evil controller of the American Empire,
The fact is, Bristol is an international city, and it will remain an international city whatever arrangements are finally made with the EU. And, of course, the Tory government are in a bind, because Liam Fox went to America the other week as the new international trade bod, and he said, right, well, we're going to be leaving the European Union, and we're going to be leaving the European single market. Can we do a deal with you? And then immediately Theresa May had him on the phone saying, hang on a minute, we haven't agreed that we are leaving the single market. He said, oh, I thought we'd agreed that. So the Tory party is split down the middle on this. The right wing want to leave the single market, the left wing don't. And I presume that that's probably the position of the Labour leadership as well. And so that's not been resolved. And the other problem underlying all of that is all of these people who are the right wingers who want to leave the European single market want to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is a deal between the corporations in the US and the EU in which Britain will have no say whatsoever,
yeah, which,
and we'll just be told what to do.
By the way, will allow the food industry to sue the government if they try and have any decent food standards.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, it's a bit of a contradiction. Peter Lilly, who's a Tory MP on the right, or I think he's in the Lords now, he's opposed to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. But we're going to hear an awful lot more about that, because Liam Fox and the right wing want to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, paradoxically enough, which is a deal between the US and the EU. In other words, everything about our standards in industry and so on will be set by that deal, which will be a deal between Washington and Brussels, which we will then sign up for as Britain. Totally contradictory. They don't know what they're talking about.
Wasn't Liam Fox supposed to be a Brexit campaigner?
He was a Brexit campaigner, so he's in favour of Brexit so that we can sign TTIP, which is a deal between the EU and Brussels. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Come on, Liam, what are you up to? Anyway, what do you make of this whole sort of Brexit initiative by the Mayor?
I think it's a good thing. I agree with Marvin that obviously the numbers speak for themselves that Bristol didn't vote to leave the EU. I campaigned to remain along with my union, and that was on the basis of employment rights and employment protection. But I must admit, it was very, very hard to get that message through to our members, and I've had some real difficult debates. And I suppose the main driving force behind the vote to leave, in my view, was immigration. I'll have to be honest about that. That was people's view of immigration. Anyway.
Okay, I don't agree. I think the main reason people voted to remain was because they want to be ruled by Westminster, not Brussels. That's a basic, simple fact. You know, in Britain's interest, not in Europe's interest as a whole.
I think there was an element.
They're not up for a United States of Europe. I mean, that's what the European Union is becoming.
Well, the members I represent, blue collar sort of postal workers. I don't think that was at the top of their list. I think it was probably immigration. There was a bit of sort of nationalism around it about, yeah, we're Britain, we can do things alone, that kind of thing. But I would say the main driving force for the Leave vote as a whole across the country was the immigration issue, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I mean, so is it okay for Bristol to say, well, we don't agree with the referendum, we're going to go our own way?
No, I think I think we have to accept the result. I accept the result. People voted for Brexit. It's democracy. You can't say, oh, just because a couple of million of poorly educated people voted to leave and they didn't know what they're voting for.
Some well-educated people voted for it as well.
But that's what it smells of when people say, oh, we should just ignore it, in my view. It's people who didn't know what they were doing voted for it, so we can ignore them. So I think there's a little bit of snobbery around it. But what we have to do is protect the sort of business arrangements, the jobs, the employment rights, and we have to say to EU nationals here that they're welcome in Bristol, the ones that are here at the moment.
I mean, we've talked on this show several times about the concept that the economy could just literally go downhill, off a cliff at any moment, like literally in the next 10 minutes. Actually, Fridays is when it happens. And that would then possibly be blamed on Brexit and or any other thing. I mean, it could be an outbreak of war, could be a stopping of oil supplies. It's all sorts of reasons why that might happen. But anyway, look, let's go and have a look at some of the other news this week. And dive into look at some of the things that have been going on in the Labour. Since we've got two Labour people here, if Smarmy Owen Smith is the answer, Labour is asking the wrong question. Now, this is the Today editor, Ron Liddell, who, by the way, was sacked for criticising the royal family from the BBC, which I was really disgusted by. I mean, the BBC's job is to criticise people in power, and because he criticised the royal family, he was booted out. And he says on Owen Smith, a smarmy post-tribunite non-entity swathed in unrealistic ambition. And that was Owen Smith's boss at the Today programme when he was working there. So that was one of the, it was in an article in The Spectator. Now, what do you make of what's been going on, Kai? Because the Labour Party seems to be fighting itself when it should be actually out there being in opposition.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm a Jeremy Corbyn supporter. Obviously, he got elected with a big mandate last year. I think there's a hardcore of MPs on the right of the party that never accepted that result, and some of them undermined him from day one. And I think they were just waiting for their excuse to take him out.
They undermined him from day one, how come he appointed so many of these people to the shadow cabinet?
Well, a lot of them refused to serve, didn't they? So, and I think that says a lot, doesn't it? Very able people. I may not totally agree with their politics, but Jeremy Corbyn offered a sort of a cross-party cabinet in terms of the range of views, and a number of the sort of able people from the right didn't serve. So I think that says a lot, that they weren't behind what he stood for, the economic message.
Well, it's also they weren't behind the membership. That's the interesting thing. I think for a politician, they've got to make their mind up of whether they're serving the country, serving their members, or whether they're leaders who are telling everyone else what to do.
I hear the argument from the MPs, we represent more than our members, we represent a constituent. And I kind of get that, and I think most members will give their MP a bit of leeway. But at the end of the day, you're a Labour MP. How many Labour MPs would have got elected if they stood as independents? 5, 10 at most. So they're there because they're Labour candidates. So I think that you have to weight that fact to how you behave.
So do you think that this coup had been brewing for a while, or was it genuinely spontaneous after the referendum?
I think they were looking for it. The first excuse was the Oldham by-election. If you look at the media around that by-election for a week, it painted a picture of what a disaster the result was going to be. And in the end, it was a very good result. There's a couple of other by-elections where we're told by the media it's going to be a disaster. Corbyn won that. The local elections were going to be
back in May, yeah.
And if it was a disaster, I think they're just looking for an excuse. And the EU referendum was a nice excuse to pull the trigger. And I mean, one thing that I do like to say is that the word coup gets bandied about, but what it really means is to seize power without democracy. And I think if you put into those terms, then you can understand the frustration of some members that voted in Jeremy Corbyn a year ago, only to have their democratic decision to sort of be ignored by those MPs, and it is to seize power without democracy. That's what they try to do, and I don't think that's a good thing for a democratic party to do. Really, we've got rules and processes, and procedures and elections, and that's the way to do things.
Martin, ex-Lib Dem peer, is one of the biggest donors to the new anti-Corbyn campaign. This is Tom Peck in The Independent. A new anti-Corbyn Labour centrist organisation, Labour Tomorrow, has been set up by David Blunkett, and it's being bankrolled by one of the party's biggest donors, an ex-Lib Dem peer, hedge fund manager and multi-millionaire human rights charity patron are all among the donors to Labour Tomorrow, a new centre-left organisation which the Blairite peer David Blunkett is director. It can be revealed, according to records published by the Electoral Commission, outspoken Lib Dem peer Matthew Oakeshott gave £25,000 to the new organisation last month.
Well, what this shows is that this is about substantial political issues. You've got Liberal Democrats here funding a Labour campaign, and of course the logical corollary of all of this is if the right of the Labour Party aren't happy in the Labour Party, they should join something like the Liberal Democrats and campaign for proportional representation, which I've always been in favour of. The problem is with the first past the post system, there's an absolute premium placed upon party unity, and what they've done by doing what they've the coup, if you want to call it that, whatever we want to call it, is even if Corbyn loses the next election, the excuse for losing is clear. It's because you stabbed me in the back, and it's not even clear that in that situation Corbyn would resign. Now we've got actually a political system which is not fit for purpose. We've got proportional representation in across the Severn Bridge in Wales. We've got proportional representation in Scotland. We've got proportional representation from mayoral elections in Bristol and elsewhere.
And in Northern Ireland,
we've got proportional representation in Northern Ireland, which they didn't have in 1969 because 3,000 people had to die before the electoral system was changed to everybody's satisfaction. The British electoral system is basically bust, and I would like to see, and I believe John MacDonald is in favour of this, we've got to put it in the Labour manifesto that we're going to look at changing the electoral system, not least because the Tories are now going to re-engineer the constituencies and that will give the opportunity, of course, inside the Labour Party to deselect MPs
and,
who were unhappy.
And also there was a pretty amazing article in the Daily Mail at the weekend, Why I Despise Jeremy Corbyn and His Nazi Stormtroopers, by Jewish Labour donor Michael Foster. He gave Labour £400,000 to help fight the last election. Saturday of last week, he says, in my hometown of Camborne, the Corbyn circus rolled into town, and he goes on and on and on to accuse Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters of being Sturmabteilung, Martin, I don't know if you can help us with what that means, but it doesn't sound very nice, and Nazi stormtroopers. I think we all know who they are.
Well, the SA were the paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party in the 1930s. It's pretty extreme rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, this guy actually sued the party as well. He's the guy that took us to court to try and prevent an election taking place on the grounds that the NEC had made the wrong decision. So, I mean, I'm quite sure that most Labour Party members and certainly Labour Party voters have never heard of this guy.
But he's quite within his rights to sue the party if he wants to. Mr Foster said that Corbyn's team was an aggressive, holier-than-thou cadre of committed hard-left socialists who excluded, briefed against, then often threatened and intimidated their opponents.
Well, I don't agree with that analysis, but he's entitled to his view. But I think the answer to him is going to be given on September the 21st, when it will be absolutely clear that Corbyn has won overwhelmingly the second election. Foster, if he really doesn't like it, can resign from the Labour Party. And also, of course, people like Tony Blair, who said that he'd rather Labour lost than a left-wing Labour Party came to power. And we've got grudges with him. Maybe we should be insisting that Labour Party cards are not for everybody. And maybe Tony Blair should be the first on the list to have his Labour Party card removed.
Well, funny you mentioned Blair, Kai, because Michael Foster says, if you are like me, a Jewish donor to Labour, you are smeared as a Blairite.
Well, I don't. What's that got to do with it? It's my opinion. Doesn't matter if you're a Jewish member. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's got Jewish supporters, and I don't see what that's got to do with it. I mean, I know a member down in Cornwall who's actually put in an official complaint about the language used by Mr. Foster, so I hope that obviously gets dealt with.
Cause I actually put some questions into all three local Labour MPs earlier this week and haven't had a single response from any of them about this. I said, have you got anything to say about these comments about your fellow party members and your party leader being Nazis and stormtroopers? And I haven't had a reply from any of them. So
I would suggest that sort of remark is over the line. How can you accuse socialist activists of being Nazis? You can if you want, but it's not really a sensible sort of thing to say, is it? It's like us accusing the Israeli government of being Nazis. They're very nasty. They're in breach of international law. They've done all sorts of horrible things. But are they Nazis? It would be extreme of me to say so. So why should you accuse us of being Nazis? It's not the right sort of language to use, is it?
But I think it's very telling that neither Thangam Debonair's office, nor Kerry McCarthy's office, nor Karen Smith's office would reply to my request for any kind of comment on whether they thought that was acceptable language, Kai.
Well, to be honest, if I was them, I probably wouldn't give a comment on that, because really it's a matter for the sort of disciplinary processes within the party, so it's probably something that the NEC or the General Secretary's office would comment on, really, if a complaint has gone in. So I can understand why, you know, they haven't commented on it, really.
But I think this, I mean, I'm not just talking about these three MPs. I would expect, you know, more people from the Owen Smith camp in the Parliamentary Labour Party, more MPs, to say, have something to say about this. It just seems incredible to me that you can use such slurs as that and get away with it, and that the people in your own party have nothing to say. Nothing to say at all.
I think if it came from a Jeremy Corbyn supporter, then it would be all over the press, wouldn't it?
It would.
So, you know, that's a fact, to be honest.
Oh, Labour leadership contest. Jeremy Corbyn refuses to take part in hustings hosted by biased media organisations. You're talking about the media there, Kai. Campaign director accuses The Mirror, The New Statesman, The Guardian and Channel 4 of taking partisan positions against Jeremy Corbyn's leadership or campaign. John Landsman, director of Momentum, a group running Corbyn's leadership campaign, wrote in an email that all four had taken partisan positions. And there's another story as well. This is from the independent media, persistently biased against Corbyn. An academic study finds the BBC was especially criticised in a report which found reporters in its main evening broadcasts use more pejorative language to describe Corbyn and his supporters. However, the research did not look at the wider range of BBC political journalism. BBC journalists use language deemed by the researchers to emphasise hostility, intransigence and extreme positions more frequently in these programmes, such as the words hostile and hardcore. In addition, almost twice as much unchallenged airtime was given to people criticising Corbyn than his allies on the BBC. The report found ITV News was found to have given considerably more equal attention to opposing views, but both outlets were found to have a huge imbalance of issues in favour of Corbyn's critics, particularly in headline stories. The Independent was among the online outlets, well, they're writing about themselves here, they would say that, no, but actually that is in this report, found to have had the most balanced coverage of Corbyn, along with the Huffington Post and International Business Times. Well, it seems to me like you don't switch on the BBC, Kai, if you want to find out what's going on in the Labour leadership contest.
Well, I think that there is an attempt to kind of create an atmosphere of crisis, I believe, and an attempt to sort of diminish the policy platform that Corbyn's standing on, because say, for example, Corbyn survives, doesn't win the election, I think it shifts the debate and the centre of gravity in terms of politics to put forward a socialist position, and I think people are frightened of that, and I think they'll do whatever they can to discredit that. And some of these outlets are very close to some of the establishment interests in this country, aren't they? The big business interests, the more established power.
If the banksters don't like them, don't they just buy them up and change the manager and change the editor? Martin, what do you make of this? This is really, it's quite a good survey here, and considerable, you know, this is a proper academic look. I'm just trying to find out who he was, the actual, University of London, Media Reform Coalition and Birkbeck University of London report.
Well, I mean, it basically confirms, as Ken Loach says in the article, what we knew already about the bias against all socialist dialogue in the media, not just Jeremy Corbyn. Say we'd had somebody else in a similar position, Diane Abbott or John McDonnell, I'm sure they'd be receiving pretty much the same treatment. But of course, the real shocker is the BBC, because their charter obliges them to be impartial. And I think we should put lots of pressure on them to make sure that they are impartial going forward.
It's interesting, I think, the difference between our local regional BBC here, which is by no means perfect, but it seems to give a lot more balance than the national. It seems like, you know, that London media is my bugbear, because they do all of the international and national coverage, pretty much. And if there's a story that they don't want to get out, they send it out to the regions, and then it gets some good coverage. But it seems to me it's like an apex, the pyramid, where the national and international media, all done from London, is much more controlled than the regional press.
Seems to be more about the narrative, doesn't it? The general narrative that they have the most influence over, the story, the headline. And I think
What do you mean by that, the narrative? What? How do you mean?
Well, the sort of framework of the debate, they kind of set it, don't they? If you see what I mean. And you can only have a debate within that certain framework, otherwise it's
a thought crime. I know what you mean. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I think, like, this is important. The general election was quite interesting last year, about the sort of narratives that were constantly being pushed about about the SNP running the country and stuff like that if Labour win. And I think the people that were put up to do interviews all the time, though, I mean, the SNP got amazing coverage on the BBC, and it kind of emphasised that overall narrative. And I think there's something sort of, there's something to that, I believe.
Well, for me, one of the most important things is this child sexual abuse inquiry, which goes to the heart of government, the royalty, the BBC, etc. And yet, nothing about that are featured in the general election campaign whatsoever. It's like it's taboo. Right. But anyway, Martin, let's just look briefly at Moody's, who've cut Johnson Press deeper into junk. Well, they actually run the I newspaper, which split from the Independent, which that other article was from. The I newspaper apparently is going all right, but Johnson is a regional newspaper arm, and they have been cut from something called CAA, maybe you can help explain what this means, CAA1 to CAA2, the third lowest possible ranking. So it looks like Johnson Press are heading under.
like a lot of traditional media organisations, because the way in which people consume news is changing dramatically. And I think if you look at the Labour leadership election campaign, you'll see this, in that the mainstream right-wing MPs thought that all they needed to do was get the Newsnight editors on side on BBC, and then they would bamboozle their way to power. But in actual fact, the Corbyn campaign is based around social media organising, pretty much like the Bernie Sanders campaign in the US. And that's the way forward. That's the future. And we've got Kerry McCarthy, who's supposedly an expert on social media, basically failing to understand how it actually works.
Yeah, and criticising me for giving my views about Labour politics, which I did find a little bit strange. Anyway, let's go on to the Tories now, because they plan, apparently, to stop... This is from The Canary, which is a pretty interesting, fairly new, interesting website to get your news from. It would be nice if they did a newspaper. I think they'd probably do rather well. The Tory plan to stop 4 million people voting in the next general election. If you want to vote in an election, you will have to produce proof of your ID in future. That's according to plans drawn up by former Conservative Cabinet Minister Sir Eric Pickles. What the Tories aren't telling you, and this will mean over 4 million people won't be able to vote. Hey, wow, thanks guys. Example percentages of people with the correct ID include less than 1% of men who are economically inactive in the urban southeast, aged 25 to 44. I mean, there's a whole load of things that you've got to have, like you've got to have your passport and loads of other things in order to vote. Kai, now this does seem like just freezing the poor out from the elections.
Well, I think it's what Tories do, isn't it? There's no surprise, is it, really? And obviously, what it means is, if you haven't got a passport or a driving licence, then obviously you're going to struggle to vote, aren't you? And what kind of people haven't got a passport or haven't got a driving licence? It's obviously people that are going to be on a lower sort of economic level that are possibly going to be frozen out from voting, really. I mean, I've got a lot of connections with Brazil, actually, and they've got compulsory voting there. But they've also, I mean, they've got ID cards as well. So I think if you're going to go for a compulsory voting system, then you'd probably need some sort of identification. But
we had Gary Hopkins on here last week, and he was basically saying, look, the problem is with the postal votes. So all they need to do is really tweak the postal votes. We may well find that the election fraud which went on in East London, which he blamed on the Muslims, of course, as they always do, will be sorted out.
Well, if you look at turnout on postal votes, it's considerably higher than turnouts on the normal votes, especially in local elections. And so,
but what he's saying is, are they fraudulent?
I doubt it.
Well, that's what he was saying. Yeah, that it's too easy to defraud a postal vote. You can get somebody else to sign it. Whatever, it's not properly checked. I don't want to give people ideas here, but it is definitely open to fraud. Though, Martin, another one here is 26% of women employed in routine or manual jobs in the urban southeast, aged between 45 and 55, won't be able to vote. That's a quarter of the electorate.
Well, they're copying these tactics from the US, where once you get yourself into power, it's I'm all right, Jack, pull up the ladder. So their advisors are saying, right, we're going to redraw the constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers. Now, we know... I know from campaigning in this area that there are lots of people in inner city areas who are not registered to vote. And if you're going to redraw the electoral boundaries on the basis of the electoral registers, that is a gerrymandering exercise. And then, of course, I mean, in the article here, they're saying that they're probably hoping to get up to 30 more Tory MPs as a result of fixing the electoral system like that. And this is all dependent upon sticking with first-past-the-post, the first-past-the-post electoral system that led to the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland in 1969, and then to a 30-year war in which 3,500 people died. The Tories are playing with fire here if they disenfranchise the inner cities, which is what they're intending to do. And this attack on Look for Rahman, I mean, it's all ad hoc, it's all ad hominem. I mean, one of the things they've accused him of is using undue spiritual influence to bear on Muslim voters to vote for him.
Okay.
What that means is that he's actually well-liked in his own community.
Well, same subject, we've just seen when we've had loads of these Muslim so-called hate preachers over the years, haven't we? Abu Hamza, Abu Qatada, all kind of moved out of the country or imprisoned, etc. The latest one is Anjem Chowdhury. So I thought I'd have a little listen to his views. And if you, both of you, I'd like Kai and Martin to just give us your views on whether you think that this guy should have been jailed. I think it's for 10 years he's been in, he's going to be jailed for, and whether you think his views are so wicked, evil, inciting violence, whatever, that, that he should have been jailed. So let's have a listen to Anjem Chowdhury on CNN. He's talking to CNN's Brian Stelter.
You will never find something different from what I say publicly to what I say privately. I believe that the Sharia is the best way of life. I believe one day it will come to America and the rest of the world.
When I hear you say that, I've been American, I know you've said it in the last few days, it reads to me as something that's preposterous. But I respect that you try to get your message out however you can. What I wonder, though, is aren't you abusing the press freedoms that you would like to see eliminated under Sharia law?
No, actually, you know, I believe that Allah created eyes to see and a tongue to speak. You know, nobody says to you, you know, that you have a right to speak. Rather, this is something that Allah created and He gave you the ability to speak. So, you know, I don't abide by the parameters of your acceptable behavior. One day, you know, people are freedom fighters. The next day, they are terrorists. At the end of the day, what I say is that we act within the boundaries of divine law. And that allows me to speak, you know, and I will use every means at my disposal to pass the Islamic message. Now, if that agrees with your own principles of democracy and freedom,
but
then
this
fine
kind
enough,
of,
if it does not.
This kind of network, yeah, and this kind of conversation would not happen under the kind of environment that you'd like to see exist.
Actually, no, you're wrong about that. I believe in an Islamic state where we can have a decent debate and discussion.
Including independent media? There's no independent media like this in Syria.
Well, you know, at the current time in Syria and Iraq, let's face it, there's an uprising taking place. People are removing brutal regimes and they're implementing the Sharia. And by all accounts, the Christians are returning to Mosul. Many Yazidis have embraced Islam. So, you know, don't believe your own propaganda.
When you say the Yazidis have embraced Islam, that's under the sword. There have been so many clear reports about that happening under threat of death.
Actually, you know, it's not entirely true. You know, I mean, I think there are many Yazidis...
Not entirely true. What do you mean?
It's not entirely, because basically, look, I mean, if you look at the Yazidis, those people who were in charge, they were supporting Nouri al-Maliki under the American occupation. And obviously, there are some people among them who need to be caught, they need to be arrested and tried. But for the vast majority of the people, especially the women and children, nobody will ever target. But for the vast majority of the people, they can embrace Islam.
Martin, Anjem Chowdhury is really saying there is that... that ISIS are attacking a brutal regime in Damascus. They're attacking Assad, as are al-Nusra, who he also supports. So, I mean, isn't he effectively saying the same sort of thing as the British government is saying?
Pretty much, and also pretty much as what some of the people in the US have been saying. I mean, the al-Nusra Front, as you know, have changed their name to the something else, the Sham Liberation Front.
Which you couldn't make it up, could you, really?
Yeah, well, I mean...
Just to let people know, the Sham, actually, in English, that's Arabic, but in English means the Levant. So the Levant Liberation Front is now the Sham Liberation Front.
So al-Qaeda... which we supposedly had a 15-year war on terror, millions displaced, hundreds of thousands killed. Al-Qaeda Libya was known as Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and our Special Forces and Air Force supported them to overthrow the Gaddafi regime, and then weaponry from Libya was transferred to Syria, and all by our own Special Forces. And at the same time, Chowdhury's opinions are ridiculous, but then on the other hand, they're not that similar from the ones expressed by the US State Department.
What he's saying about the Yazidis converting to Islam? Is that a sort of imprisonable offence?
Well, you know, I think he's just basically, he's acting as a kind of, you know, that's what he'd like to believe, but it's not true. But the fact is, there is an issue about whether people should be sent to prison for saying silly things. Is that what our prisons are for? And don't forget that Abu Qatada, who... Home Secretary Theresa May boasted that she'd sent him to Jordan. That was because he'd spent 9 years in prison in Britain and they couldn't find anything against him. Then they sent him to Jordan in the hopes that the Jordanians would find something. They couldn't find anything and they had to release him. So this guy had spent nearly 15 years in prison, Abu Qatada, part of the Al-Mujahirun group like Chowdhury. And in actual fact, they haven't got any evidence against him at all, other than that he's a bit of a stupid...
So they let him go. And also worth mentioning mentioning that the Queen let it slip that she was one of the people who was behind forcing or trying to force the government to get rid of Abu Qatada. So that was quite an interesting little revelation, because the Queen is not supposed to be political. Anyway, what do you make of this all this guy? Should this guy be behind bars for what he said? I mean, I think it's fair to say, from what he said just there, he's basically saying that people should support ISIS, people should support the al-Nusra Front in Syria, and he's also saying that the Yazidi Christians have converted to Islam of their own free will rather than being forced to by the terrorists.
Well, I think she said that that transcript, obviously, that you've just played us wasn't the transcript used against him in court. I mean, I don't agree with his opinion on ISIS, to be honest with you. I think they're the worst group involved in that conflict. It'd be interesting to see the transcript of what he actually said. That I think the charge was inviting support for the IS group. So
he was doing that there. I mean, he was basically praising ISIS for fighting these terrible regimes, which actually the British government says Assad is a terrible regime too.
So there must be a threshold then that you cross where it becomes
It depends if you're a Muslim or not a Muslim. I mean, General Petraeus openly called for the support of Al-Qaeda, al-Nusra Front in Syria. But then being as he's a retired US general, he's allowed to say stuff like that.
Maybe you should wear an Anjem Chowdhury outfit and see if he can get away with it.
As you will know, a couple of years, about 18 months ago, a guy was put on trial at the Old Bailey for supposedly going to join a group fighting in Syria, and the West Midlands police put him on trial. His defence was that MI6 were arming and training that particular group. The trial was dropped. In other words, there's overwhelming evidence that British Special Forces, the SAS, were photographed Martin. In Jordan, last in yes, Syria
Martin.
Last week.
Yes, Martin. Police officers move on. Police officers investigated over Dalian Atkinson's taser death. That was earlier this week. Vikram Dodd in The Guardian. Two West Mercia police officers are under criminal investigation over the death of former Premier League footballer Dalian Atkinson, who died after he was tasered three times by the police. Now, this was, I imagine, some sort of drunken thing. The police decided, rather than try and actually physically arrest him, they'd taser him and they killed him. I mean, these tasers... there's been calls since that to actually stop police using tasers. These are lethal weapons, Kai.
Yeah, it seems very much over the top, doesn't it? We weren't there, we weren't on the ground, but did he have a weapon? I don't know if he had a. Doesn't sound like he had a weapon.
There's certainly been no reports of him having any kind of weapon. No,
an aggressive incident, maybe drinks involved. Would you use a taser under those circumstances? I probably wouldn't if I was a police officer. I mean, if had a weapon or something like that, then maybe that would be an appropriate response. But it does seem very much over the top, and to taser someone three times as well. I don't know if that's really
50,000 volts, Martin. Yeah, well. 50,000 volts.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously this is a very regrettable incident, and I'm quite sure that the police officer who actually administered the tasering probably doesn't feel too happy with the results of what's been done.
Any confidence the IPCC will do a decent inquiry here? Because it doesn't seem like many of these police officers ever get properly prosecuted.
As you know, there's a big issue in the black community about the deaths in police custody of black young people and older people, and nobody is to blame. You can say sometimes that maybe, you know, the police get it wrong and sometimes they get it right, but nobody has ever been held to account for any of these deaths in police cars.
Final story, climate change. Netherlands are on the brink of banning the sale of petrol-fuelled cars. This is Europe appearing to be poised to continue to move towards cutting fossil fuel use. The Netherlands joins a host of nations looking to pass innovative green energy laws. Also, the self-driving Ford is coming. Ford's fleet of self-driving cars will have to be here in just 5 years. What do you make of these two? Quickly, Kai.
I think there's got to be a cut-off point where we get to petrol-free cars, and I don't know exactly when that would be, maybe within the next 20 years or so.
So the Dutch leading the way, effectively. Yeah. What about self-driving cars? Good idea or not?
Well, I think there's going to be problems. But I suppose once the technology is right, then it's probably the future. But I can see.
Well, I'd say if the technology is ever right. And anyway, if someone's killed, who's responsible? Time now for the Murdoch News at 6.